Welcome to the podcast of Grace Covenant Church, where we are transformed by God's grace, connected through relationships, and committed to service.
Thanks for joining us today. I know for some of you, it's especially hard to get out of the house on a rainy day like today. That's fun, though. Yeah, the kids want to go play in the rain, and you're like, nope, not in the church clothes. Hey, listen, we're in about, I think, week six now in our series called All In. And we spent about five of those weeks looking at the uniqueness of Jesus Christ and the claims that he made, and then last week we looked at some consequences of that, just dominoes falling, right? If Jesus is this way, then it just makes sense to be all in, right? And we're just looking at what it means to be all in all aspects of our lives. Now, last week we focused on the primary hindrance in most people's lives of being all in. We looked at a guy that just wants to hold on to his stuff instead of holding on to Jesus. Now, I hope you were able to grasp that last week we were emphasizing that Jesus never, ever asks people to surrender or to sacrifice, better way. Because whenever he asks people to do something, it's always so that they get more, better, and eternal rewards. More, better, and eternal rewards. So Jesus is asking you to trade in your plastic little truck for a brand new Ford F-150 that works. And he's just trying to get the plastic thing away from you. That's the message that Jesus tells over and over again. He doesn't want you to get to heaven and say, oh my goodness, I had an accumulation of plastic trucks. And that's kind of what that was about last week. And this week, what I wanted to do is look at some good news. Here, we're going to look at two completely different people that have almost nothing in common this week, except the thing they have in common is an encounter with salvation. And then they're going to have very similar responses to that encounter. And the first one I want you to find in your Bibles in 2 Kings chapter 5. Now, 2 Kings is not an easy book to find, but in 2 Kings, it is past big books like 1 and 2 Samuel, and then 1 and 2 Kings comes after that. It's before Psalms. But this is a story, oddly enough, of a foreigner who is a general for the Syrian army. And these guys were basically the bad guys. They conquered the northern tribes of Israel. And in chapter 5, verse 1, this general's name is Naaman. Now, look at his resume. You're supposed to be very impressed with this individual because he's very impressive. Now, Naaman was commander of the army of the king of Aram. He was a great man in the sight of his master and highly regarded because through him, the Lord had given victory to Aram. He was a valiant soldier, and yet he had leprosy. So what happens is, so we build up this individual's persona, and then it turns out he has leprosy. One of the conquering peoples that they have enslaved are Jews, and his wife, oddly enough, has a Jewish little girl as a slave, and that little girl says, hey, you know what? I know just the person that could help you. His name is Elijah, and he's in Samaria, and he's a prophet of God, Jehovah, and he might just be able to heal your leprosy. And so in verse 5, he gets permission to go and see Elijah. In verse 5, it says, by all means, the king of Aram replies, and take this letter to the king of Israel with you. So Naaman left, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 750 pounds of silver, 150 pounds of gold, 10 sets of clothing, and a letter from the king for Israel to read. And it says, with this letter, I am sending you my servant Naaman, that you may cure him of leprosy. So you're supposed to respect this man greatly. If you could just imagine, this would be a picture's worth a thousand words. Maximus in the movie Gladiator. He's the Secretary of State to the king. He travels with the king. He gives the king advice on warfare, and he is a veteran soldier who is much decorated and greatly respected. But it says, you know, kind of the hanging thing there, but he has leprosy, an incurable disease. And his only hope, because he can't find anything in Syria to help him, is to go to Israel for maybe this prophet called Elijah. And so he does what you're supposed to do, and that is to bring a lot of money. So he brings, what, 150 pounds of gold, 750 pounds of silver, 10 changes of clothing, right? A letter from the king, an entourage, chariots, guards, soldiers guarding all that, all those valuable things. And he goes down there because, well, why wouldn't you? How much does it cost to cure leprosy? Does it matter? Because you're going to pay it, aren't you? And so he fills wagons full of gold and silver and makes sure he's wearing just the right outfit when he gets there because he wants to impress people. In verse 9, this is what happens. So he shows up at the little hut of Elijah. In verse 9, so Naaman went with his horses and his chariots, and he stops at the door of Elijah's house. This is good. Elijah sends his messenger out to say to him, go wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan River, and your flesh will be restored, and you'll be clean. Now, Naaman went away angry and said, I thought that he would surely come out. He would come out to me and stand in front of me and call on the name of Jehovah his God and wave his hands over the spot and cure me of leprosy. Are not Abin and Pephar, these other rivers in Damascus, any better than the waters of Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be cleansed? So he went off in a rage. So you see what's happening? Naaman is a very important person, and he knows he's a very important person. And when he shows up with his 750 pounds of silver and his 150 pounds of gold and his 10 different clothing sets, right, and his letter to the king, Elijah sends out a servant and says, just go to that shallow river not far from here. It's the Jordan. If you go there, take 7 baths, you'll be done. He is wrecking Naaman's world. He's changing his whole worldview around because here's how it's supposed to happen. The way it's supposed to happen is I'm an important person. I show up with my entourage, right? You know, the limousines pull up and I get out and then he comes out to me. I pay him a loot of money. Now he's obliged. Then he does his incantations. And then I'm healed. But that's not at all what happens here. God is trying to show this man and you and I that things are different in his economy of grace. And I mean, if you could imagine, this is like, let's just call this Club Salvation. This will help, okay? This is Club Salvation. And this guy, this is like one of these exclusive clubs, and there's that roped off area, and there's a bodyguard out front, right? And he lets some people in. And so Naaman pulls up, right, in just the Escalades, right? One after another after another, and he gets off, and people are opening the doors for him, and he comes out, and he says, well, you know, I'm here to go to Club Salvation. And the doorman comes out and says, if you go down the back alley, it's kind of nasty back there, but if you just go down that back alley, there's a door you can get in, and you'll just walk right in there. So he's mad that he's not getting in right away. He's mad that he's got some servant telling him where to go. And he's pretty upset that he's going to go down some back alley, really? Aren't there better rivers up where I'm from? I think there are. The Jordan River is, you know, shallow sometimes. It's cold all the time. If this is the way this God works, that means that heroes make no difference than cowards. That means successful people are on the same footing as failures. That means that important people are not all that as important as just regular people. It means everybody's playing on a level field. You see? And Naaman's not liking that. Because the man in charge, Elijah here, doesn't even know about his gold and his silver and his wardrobe and his letter. And so he's just going to say, pack it up, boys. We're going home. Because what's happening to Naaman here is what happens to every person that doesn't receive healing of soul. Pride. He's too proud to take a bath in a common river. And so he's too proud to receive a cleansing. He has to heal the leprosy in his soul before he could have healed the leprosy of his skin. And proud people and stubborn people and self-centered people and self-righteous people, they don't know about the goodness of God. The Spirit of God doesn't work miracles in their lives, you know. Like, they're not doing things that only people that are just jacked up on Jesus can do. Because they're too busy being proud and stubborn and self-centered. And so, let's roll them up, boys. We're going home. Because I don't use back alleys and I don't go through the back doors. And then his servants, who know maybe it's something about humility, say this in verse 13. Naaman's servant went up to him and says, your father, if the prophet had told you to do something great, you know, like get the wicked witch of the West's broom or something, wouldn't you have done that? Well, how much more then when he tells you wash and be cleansed? And so Naaman does that. So he goes down and he dips himself in the Jordan River 7 times as the man of God told him, and his flesh was restored and he became clean like a young boy. All better. The servant gets in this and says, just swallow your pride. We traveled all this distance. Could you just go down there and take a bath 7 times? Come on. Let's just, for curiosity's sake, let's give this thing a try. And so he does, and he comes up like a boy. And guess what? You know, when you go in the back door through the back alley, you end up in the club salvation. And his skin is representing his soul. It's metaphorical here. I mean, it's true, but it's true. His skin is like that of a young boy, and his soul is renewed. This is born again. This is him born again. And now the dominoes start falling. This is what happens. These are just natural consequences when you encounter the grace of God that is absolutely transformational. Look at verse 15. So Naaman and all his attendants went back to the man of God, and he stood before him. Now Naaman's coming out, or Elisha's coming out, and he says, Now I know that there is no other God in all the world except Israel. Please accept now a gift from your servant. And the prophet answers and says, surely as Jehovah lives, whom I serve, I will not accept a thing. And even though Naaman argued with him, he's arguing with Maximus, okay? He refused. I will not, said Naaman, if you will not allow me to give you this money, then please let your servant be given as much earth as a pair of mules can carry, for your servant will never again make a burnt offering and sacrifices to any other god but Jehovah. And may Jehovah forgive your servant for this one thing. When my master, the king, enters the temple of Rimmon to bow down and he is leaning on my arm and I bow down there also, when I bow down at the temple of Rimmon, would Jehovah forgive your servant for this? And Elijah says, you can go in peace. Here are the two dominoes that fall after you get nailed by the grace of God and are forgiven and your soul is cleansed like a boy, brand new. The first thing that happens is you get crazy generous. He goes back to Elijah. And now listen, he's not giving the money so that God will work in him. It is because God has already worked. See, he's not paying off God here. He's not like, I'm going to give you this money and now you need to heal me. He's been healed and he says, now I don't know what to do with this gratitude. And so he wants to give him, this is just classic salvation. You're not doing great things for God so that he'll love you, but because he already has. But in this situation, Elisha won't have any part of it because this is a brand new believer that has his whole worldview of deities where he believes that he can manipulate and pay them to do his biddings. And so Elijah's stepping back and saying, look, I don't want to ruin this or dilute it in any way. I don't want to confuse you. I want you to see that always and forever, grace is free or it's not grace. So just keep it. The first thing is you get overwhelmingly generous. The second thing that happens is you go back to work. Look what he does. I mean, look what he does. He says, look, okay, fine. If you're not going to take my money, then I got a couple things I got in my head. Can I get a wagon full of Israeli dirt? And I'm sure Elijah was happy to do that. There's a lot of dirt down there. You can take your dirt. And so he takes it up back to Syria so that when they worship the Syrian god there, he'll lay the dirt down and he'll be kneeling on Israeli soil. so that he'll never be compromising his commitment to the only true God. Because Rimmon is not like a god of Syria. It is the deification of Syria. And so he says, look, I have to go back to work, which I love this. I have to go back to work. He doesn't say, look, don't make me go back there. You know, there's pagans up there. There's all kinds of mean idol worship. And in the water cooler, they tell dirty jokes. And you wouldn't believe my boss or my job description that I have. No, he doesn't say any of that. He goes, look, I'm going to go back and I'm going to serve the king. And one of the things I do is I help the king into that temple. He's going to hold on to my arm. He's going to bend down to kneel before it. And I'm going to have to be there with him. Is there something we could work out? He goes back to work. But again, it's a whole new way of doing work. I will go serve my country, but I will not worship my country. I will go serve my king, but I won't worship my king. I will go back to the business I was doing, but it won't do me. I will go back to the music or back to sports like I was doing before, but it is not where I get my hope. It's not where I get my identity. It's not where I get significance and safety or security. I'm going to go back there, and I don't need success, but I will pursue success. I owe it to everyone that's working there. I don't need money, but I will pursue making more money because that's what I do. He goes back to work, but he doesn't need it anymore. It is an expression of his redemption now. Do you see? So he gets crazy generous, and he goes back to work and makes that like a sacramental event. And now here's another guy, completely opposite. Go to your New Testament, Luke chapter 19. This character is rather familiar to most of you, I'll bet. I mean, where Naaman was brave, this guy's a coward. Where Naaman was probably a big, bulky, strong guy, this is a small, little weak guy. If Naaman had the voice of Charlton Heston, this guy has, some squeaky little thing, Pee Wee Herman maybe. And again, Naaman's a hero for the nation. This guy, his name is Zacchaeus. He's a villain, okay? And so in verse 1 of chapter 19, Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. A man was there named Zacchaeus. He was the chief tax collector and was extremely wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but he was a short man. He could not because of the crowd that was gathering. And so he ran ahead and then climbed a sycamore fig tree to see him. And then because Jesus was coming that way. And when Jesus reached that spot, he looked up and said, Zacchaeus. He looked at him and he said to him, Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today. And so he came down and all at once he welcomed him gladly. Zacchaeus was a tax collector for Rome, the occupying nation of Israel. The Jews hated the Romans, and he's taking taxes for them. And it was almost like a mafia collection agency, because he could take more than he needed to take for Rome. Anything he took in addition to that was his, and he had Roman guards to enforce those collections. And so not only was he working for the bad guys, he was running up artificial bills for his own wealth. It says he was extremely wealthy. He was in charge of all the other tax collectors. He's at the top of the pyramid. And then Jesus did to him what he did to the rich young ruler we talked about last week. He looked up at him. He must have seen something in those eyes because Jesus says, look, why don't you come down right now? I'm going to have dinner at your house. An extremely vulnerable expression of acceptance when you eat it in the Near East, when you eat at someone's house, you have a meal with them. And that's why everybody, even you and I, would say, what's he doing hanging around a guy like this? And then right in the middle of this dinner, you got to wonder what's going on inside of Zacchaeus' heart, because they're not talking about Zacchaeus' wealth or anything else. But these are just dominoes falling. Look what happens in verse 8. Right in the middle of this meal, it must have been something. Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor, and if I have cheated anyone out of anything, I'll pay it back four times the amount. And Jesus said, you know what? Today salvation has come to this house, Because this man too is a son of Abraham. The Son of Man came to seek and to save that which was lost. Look what happens. Somewhere in the meal, Zacchaeus understood that salvation had come to his soul. And two dominoes fall right after that. They just happen. When you have an encounter with Jesus Christ, the first thing that happens is generosity. The next thing that happens is you go to work. And that's what happened in Zacchaeus' life. He gets generous. He stands up and he says, look, 50% of my wealth is going to the poor. He just, why not? I can afford that. And then instead of paying back 120% of what you're, you know, if you cheat someone, you know, the law says you need to pay back 120% of what you took. So if you took 100 bucks, you need to pay 120 back. He says, I'll pay back 400% back, because he wants to make sure everybody's right. Everybody's maybe even happy that they've been cheated by Zacchaeus at some time. He's coming to my house. He's coming down the block. He's got that bag of money. So not only is he generous, the other thing that's mentioned, well, it's not really mentioned here. What's not mentioned is he doesn't quit tax collecting. Why so? Well, if you're going to have your taxes collected by a Jewish person and you're Jewish, would you rather have somebody do it honestly and fairly? Or would you rather have someone do it like he'd been doing it? And so it wasn't evil within itself to be a tax collector. It was just the way he was doing it. And so Zacchaeus does not stand back and say, I got to get out of this business. I do not like the people I'm hanging around with. I don't like all the people underneath me. I taught them everything I know. And I don't even like the dirty jokes around the water cooler. I don't like kind of the conversations we have at the big board meetings. I'm going to go and do ministry or do something else. I'm going to just follow Jesus around for the rest of his life. He doesn't say that. He says, you know what? I'm going to do it right now. I'm going to go back and I'm going to earn money, but I'm not going to worship money. I'm going to go back to music or sports, but I'm not going to worship it. I'm not going to serve it. It's going to serve God. It's not where I'm going to get my identity, my hope, my security, and my significance. I don't need success, Zacchaeus. I don't need success, but I will be successful. I'll pursue it. I don't need to make a lot of money, but I'm going to pursue making money because that's what I'm supposed to do for my boss. I'll be honest about that, and I'll be generous. You see, I wanted to just kind of lay out to you two completely different types of people, two completely different testaments, two different situations and circumstances, and I want you to see that that's what happens when people get nailed by the forgiveness of God, when their souls are cleansed. Once were lepers and now they're clean. Now, so the next one is me. How about you? You know, we spent almost a year doing some diagnostic work, the leadership did, of Grace Covenant Church, and we had, some of you might have been involved with it. We took a survey. We had some experts come in and look at some of our books, and we found that we're doing well as a church. You know, our vision statement is being transformed by God's grace. That's one of them. That's one of the points. And we looked at, is that happening? What's going on in the lives of the people? Are new people coming in that have never heard about Jesus Christ or at least his forgiveness? And are they accepting that? And they are, like maybe even never before. And another way of keeping score on this transformed by God's grace was we were looking at people that had been at Grace for quite some time or had been in churches for some time. Are they getting a new understanding of that? Are they showing fruit of joy and humility and service? You know, those sorts of things. And we saw that. We saw people that had been, even in ministry, were being humbled. And because of that, they received God's grace in a new way. And they were hearing God's voice in a clearer tone. So we were pretty happy with that. And then we looked at committed to service, or I'm sorry, connected to relationships. And we looked at how we're connecting each other and with each other in this, you know, it's a big church, right? But because of the men's ministry and women's ministry and youth ministry, life groups, I think we have more people in connected communities than we ever have before, and maybe even a greater percentage of people. And some of our connecting communities are are care-driven communities, like MOPS, Mothers of Preschool, Celebrate Recovery, and there's a ministry to new mothers called Square One. I highlight these because other churches are sending their people because they need our shepherds to care for their sheep. So we're doing pretty good with that. We have work to do in this area as well, but we're doing okay. And then in the category of service, remember we said we're committed to service around Grace? We looked at that, and we saw that there were 850 positions filled last year just on this campus. But more importantly than the 850 positions that where people are serving, whether in the lobby or in Bible study or in the children's ministry, here's what was really fun. We felt like there was an atmospheric change at Grace, that people are starting to grasp that service is a good thing to do all by itself. It's a good thing to serve. And it's also a great thing to serve God's church. But also more importantly is we're starting to hear people say, I understand that the way Grace works in my life is by serving other people. In other words, it's good for my soul to stoop. And so we're seeing more and more people starting to serve because it's the right thing to do. It's a good thing for God's church, and it's good for them as well. And we're looking pretty good on their report card. And we looked at our giving. Just this last year, in kind of spontaneous, urgent needs, our church raised just over $200,000 for ministries around the city and around the world. And I don't know, it boggles my mind that happens. Sometimes in 10 days we're able to do that sort of thing. So the dominoes are falling around Grace. It's a natural consequence of being exposed to that. One of the things that came up, though, we had kind of an expert in his field look at the very details of our giving, and what he did show was that there were a number of people stuck when it came to giving. That one of the dominoes that did not fall was kind of the regular, consistent, predictable, generous giving that's joy-filled. A lot of people at Grace don't understand and don't know how to give to the cause of transformation, of connection, of service. And so I'm pointing that out to you today because there's something broken in a soul that doesn't have a natural desire to give to the church that is serving God so effectively. And if you think there's something in this for me, I want you to hear. Here's what I want you to hear. I care about your soul more than I care about the finances of this church. But it is very important that you give regularly, kind of predictably, sacrificially, joyfully to a local church. And if you think there's something in this for me, I want you to give to First Evangelical Free Church or Hope in the City. Those are two fabulous. I love those pastors. I love what they're doing. I love their staff. So give there, okay? Just call my bluff. More importantly, back to the bigger deal here is I hope that you desire this. I hope that you kind of think with your, if you're married, that you think with your mate, do you think we'll ever get to like giving 20%? What if we did some things and like in 4 years we were giving 30% for 3 years? That would be like giving an entire year's income. I mean, that would be really cool. Not because it'd be sacrificial, because you get more, better, and eternal rewards for that sort of thing. It's not trading down, don't get me wrong. But if you look at, you even look at the life of Zacchaeus. He wasn't apologetic for his wealth. He gave a ton. I would love to make enough to give 50%. I really would. I think you would too. What most people do when they get to 50% is when they get that wealthy, they still spend 105%. And that's why it would be very important. Here's the thing. I think it would be important for each of us that haven't found the understanding or the desire to give regularly, predictably, sacrificially, joyously, to like sit down with some friends and say, okay, why don't we all make a goal? And say within a certain period of time, we'll go to that Good Sense workshop, we'll do some certain crazy things, and we're going to get there together. Because if that domino doesn't fall and it's stuck, there's something stuck in you. And you're missing a lot of fun. Jesus doesn't say, to Zacchaeus, no, or here's the specific amount you should be giving and here's how to do it. He says this, and he says it to all of us. Follow me. It'll be an adventure. Just follow me. Let's just see what happens. Let's see what happens. Just follow me. I was thinking all week about what it would be like. A picture's worth a thousand words. What would a picture look like of Naaman or Zacchaeus? And then on Tuesday, pictures started coming out. You know Michael Morton? Have you seen these pictures? That's Michael Morton. That's the first few steps outside of freedom. In 1986, his wife was killed in a violent way. And while he was at his wife's funeral, the police were putting a case together to put him in jail. And using means that they shouldn't have, apparently, I don't know that for sure, but he was convicted of killing his own wife and was given a life term. This last Tuesday, after 25 years in prison, never being able to raise his only son, he walked out of that courthouse because new evidence came forward. I want you to see that face. And I'm going to ask you, that's his attorney. Is that the face of joy? Look at that. That's his brother-in-law on his right, our left. I mean, talk about dominoes falling. He's going to get $2 million, not because it's a gift, but because that's what you get paid. But he's probably going to get a lot more. I hope he does. But let me ask you. You think he's going to give some of that money to that lawyer? Think that lawyer's going to get a bonus for getting him out of jail? Oh, you bet he is. You think his best friend, his only friend that stayed with him, his employer at Safeway, an old store, a grocery store that went out of business, who testified that he didn't do it, stayed with him those 25 years and visited him in prison. You think he's going to give him a little something? I bet he does. Because that's the face of joy right there. That's what Zacchaeus looks like. That's what it looks like when you've been dinged with freedom. You just weep. You overflow. You get generous. You go back to work. That's what it looks like. That's the joy of it. It just makes it. And by the way, that is an innocent man being given justice. The stories we're talking about, the stories that you and I tell, that's of guilty men and women being given deliverance. So those pictures aren't even adequate. That's just a man getting freedom that he deserved. Our stories, there are no words for that. How's your soul? Does it overflow? Does it spill over? Does it look something or anything like this? Is this, in his interview, he says, colors just seem brighter now. I bet they do. That's what it's like to be all in. That's what it looks like, and that's what it feels like. That's what it means to be committed. That's dominoes falling. That's following a Savior. That's never surrendering or giving up. It means getting more and better and eternal. That's what it means. I hope you join us in that pursuit. Dear Heavenly Father, we are grateful. We are overflowing with gratitude that we were lost and you found us, that we were dead and now made alive. And Lord, I'd ask that you would do serious diagnostic work on our souls to help us understand if that's showing itself in everyday living. We'd ask that you'd cause us to really reflect on who we belong to and who we serve. And I'd ask that you'd bring us friends, that we would have some really tender-hearted but truth-filled conversations. And you'd cause us to be spokesmen for you in the marketplace, in our neighborhoods, in locker rooms, on soccer fields, all over the place. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
For more information about Grace, visit our website at grace360.org.